Hello, and welcome to Joe's Boys. This is a podcast for little women, little men, and everyone in between. I'm your host, Peyton Thomas. I'm the author of the novel Both Sides Now. I'm also a writer for publications like Pitchfork, Billboard, and Vanity Fair. I'm here today with my very special guest, Dr. Jennifer Putzi. Dr. Putzi is a professor at the College of William and Mary, where she teaches English and gender sexuality in women's studies. Among her course offerings, she's taught both transgender fictions and a 400-level course called 150 Years of Little Women. And after we record, she will be sending me the syllabus for that, please. She is the author of several books, including Fair Copy, Relational Poetics, and Antebellum American Women's Poetry, and Identify Marx, Race, Gender, and the Marked Body in 19th Century America. Dr. Putzi, I am so thrilled to have you here. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I am doing very well. I'm thrilled to be here.
Yes, I am so excited to have you here as well. I do want to hear more about the 150 Years of Little Women course, which maybe you can detail in my next question. What is your relationship to Little Women?
I really can't remember a time I didn't know Little Women. I remember when I was little, I had one of those sort of mini, a lot of people have talked about them on your show, that sort of mini condensed version with the pictures. I saw a photo not too long ago when I was doing research for my class of the cover, and it was just like this visceral blast to my brain. Like, I remember having that. But I also had a cup that belonged to my grandmother. So I suppose my mother must have given it to me, or I just took it off the shelf or something like that. That was from like the early 1900s.
Wow.
That I read when I was younger. So I read it. It's a book I've read over and over and over again throughout my life. And I think it's probably part of the reason why I'm a 19th century Americanist. I mean, I can't believe that that doesn't have something to do with it. I even had a dream once about Louisa May Alcott during graduate school. It was a very sort of quiet dream. We were walking in the snow and she had a hood, you know, like a cape on with a hood. And I didn't know who I was walking next to. And it was like this New England landscape. And then she pulled back her hood and looked at me. And it was her. And I remember it being like, wow, that was such an awesome dream when I woke up.
So cool. She visited you.
Yeah.
She absolutely came to visit. Wow.
So yeah. So now, I mean, I've written about Alcott a little bit. I've written about My Contraband, the short story, and a little bit of Hospital Sketches, but never about Little Women. But I've taught the novel several times now in that senior seminar, as you mentioned. And I've thought about doing, we have like major author courses, and I've thought about a major author course on Alcott. That would be fun. But students always love her, and she's a joy to teach. So,
yes. And so you haven't had a course teaching the entire Alcott canon, but you have taught 150 Years of Little Women. And yes, I am fascinated to know what that course looked like.
So we started by reading the novel. So we read the novel once in a hurry. Mm-hmm. Plow through it, initial responses, what's your relationship to it? Like really starting in sort of an emotional place. And then we spent some time talking about some of Alcott's other work. So studied her sensational fiction. I think one semester, so I did it twice. I think one semester I had them read Work, which is a later novel. And then we read a couple of other novels that were published around the same time. So in order to think about race, we read a novel, an 1859 novel by a woman named Harriet Wilson called Arnig, which is very much about like race and gender and labor. And we also read another novel called The Lamplighter by Maria Susanna Cummins. So getting them to think about genre and about like why Little Women is the way it is and how it's both similar to and different from other things that were published at the same time. And then we ended the semester with two contemporary versions of Little Women. So thinking about how people are sort of remaking or borrowing that plot. I mean, all my students are always like, why is, like, because there's not really a good trans, I mean, there's not really any trans sort of take on Little Women, a scholarly take.
Yeah. I mean, you're preaching to the choir here. You're preaching to like the choir master. Yeah. I can vouch for a number of very good books that take a queer perspective on Joe.
Yeah.
We just did an interview with Kathleen Gross, who wrote Joe, an adaptation of Little Women, sort of. There's another middle grade graphic novel adaptation.
Right.
Meg Jo Bethany-Amy. And I'm looking at Greater Nothing, which is a new one that's written by four authors that kind of transports Little Women to the Second World War, and Joe is like openly queer. Yeah. That one, but I have not investigated that. But I know that that's on the radar. But I'm very excited that people have been so receptive to having the conversation because I think it's long overdue. And I'm very excited to be speaking with someone who's been teaching like transgender fictions and 150 years of Little Women.
Yeah.
It seems to me like there's a lot of overlap there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, one thing, so when I do my trans fictions class, I've been doing all contemporary fiction.
Right.
But one thing I'd love to do is to do sort of a historically, you know, a historical take or do a sort of 19th century American trans fictions, you know, because I think there's stuff there. I mean, I'm teaching a novel right now called Fettered for Life that was published in 1874 by Lily Devereux Blake. Have you read this?
No.
Okay. And it's going to be giving something away, and I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
But there's a character throughout the book named Frank Haywood, who is like dashing journalist figure. He's the hero. He rescues the heroine. And we've been spending 4 days on it. And our fifth day, my students on Monday are going to find out that Frank is a woman dressing as a man. And yeah, and so there's all this great stuff in there. And it's just a couple of years after Little Women. And it really, I think, speaks to a lot of the same issues and a similar figure, right? I mean, a writer, someone who's very handsome, but also, I don't know, he's described as delicate in some ways and yet very handsome and brave. So yeah, there's so much good stuff.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I know that in addition to Little Women, there are Louisa May Alcott short stories that similarly reveal at the climax that someone is actually not the gender they were posing as, right?
Yeah. What a surprise that Alcott could be thinking about those things.
No, I mean, it goes back so much further than we think. I love Nevada, and I love the new edition of Nevada that was just published by Imogen.
Oh, I didn't even know there was a new one.
Yeah, no, it just came back into print after like a decade, which is so, I mean, run to watch your local bookstore.
Yeah.
If listeners don't know what Nevada is a wonderful novel by Imogen Binney that is about a trans woman who has a midlife crisis and steals her girlfriend's car and goes on a road trip and winds up in a very small town in Nevada where she meets a person who is what we would call an egg, like a trans person who hasn't hatched yet.
Right.
And sort of tries to coax this trans person out of their shell. And it's just wonderful. But that was, I believe it was published first in 2013 by Topside Press.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of been regarded as like the first trans novel. And I mean, maybe you as the trans fiction professor can speak to how not true that is. But it's also something that Imogen Binney is like, I did not invent trans literature, right. Unfortunately.
Right. Well, and yet it was important, right? And Topside was super important because Topside put out a nice sort of cluster of novels by trans folks.
Yeah.
Aoki's novel came out with Topside. So there are a lot of good texts, a lot of texts that I teach in my class.
Yeah, unfortunately, Topside is no longer with us, but Farrar, Straus, and Giroux just published a beautiful edition of Nevada. So you can.
That's great.
It's wonderful.
That's good news.
Which March sister are you? And again, for the purposes of this podcast, even though no one ever claimed Sam, Lori the March sister.
Nobody's ever claimed Lori.
No one's ever claimed Lori. It breaks my heart.
I have to say, Lori frustrates me.
Oh, okay.
Of course, Joe. I mean, I hate to be boring and say Joe, but it's Joe. You know, I wanted to be a writer when I was little. And there was just something about Joe, how she was different and how she did her own thing. I liked when she cut her hair, even though I never had short hair as a kid. I've always been, you know, an introvert. I love that she would go up in the attic and write and read and all of that. So definitely Joe.
Yes.
But I'm always interested when I teach it. So I ask the same question, and that there really are folks, you know, who consider themselves Amy's and Meg's and shockingly even Beth's.
You say shockingly. I mean, I think Beth is one of the more common. I mean, obviously Joe is the most common answer, but
yeah,
I get Beth's. Like Beth is, yeah. I think.
But she dies.
She makes a real impact before she dies.
Yeah. So I don't think I told you this story, but so my daughter refuses to read Little Women.
Yeah.
My daughter is trans. She's 16 and she refuses to read Little Women. She refuses to read anything that I think she should read. She resisted me on Harry Potter for a long time. And then it turned out she was right to resist me. So I'll go with that. But so she will read Little Women, but she did read on her own without telling me like a condensed version. Like I think just like the first book, not both books. And then she's read that Meg, Jo, Beth, and Amy, which is a graphic novel version set in, is it like Afghanistan? Or it's not set in Afghanistan, but the father goes off to war. And so we were talking about the novel at one point, and I mentioned Beth dying. And she was like, what are you talking about? And I said, Beth dies. What do you mean? What am I talking about? And she was like, Beth doesn't die. doesn't die in Meg, Jo, Beth, and Amy, and apparently did not die in that condensed version that she realized. Yep. So we have a standing argument about whether or not Beth dies, but she still refuses to read the novel.
I mean, it's like, no way, she doesn't die.
Well, I feel like if Beth is still living in your head, then that's a good reason not to read the whole book.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, just don't do it.
That is fascinating. So there are readers for whom Beth is alive. And that's just fascinating. I mean, we say that Jo is the obvious answer. I have a friend, Hal Shreve, who is a author and a librarian. And he sent me a poem that his library put on a poetry contest. And I can't share it on the podcast because it was written by a child. But he privately shared with me a blisteringly passionate 3-page poem that a child had written about Meg March and how like she was the best one. And it was so good. And I think about
it's all so the time. Fabulous.
Like, Meg has shooters out here. Like that's
not passionate about these things, you know?
Don't understand.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Today there's actually quite a lot of Meg in today's chapter.
Yes.
Chapter 20, Confidential. Dr. Putzi, would you like to just recap this one for us?
Absolutely. So Marmee is coming home. She's been off nursing Mr. March, who has been ill while he's a chaplain during the Civil War. Beth becomes ill while Marmee's gone. And so Lori sends for Marmee to come home before even the girls do. He anticipates needing her. So she comes home. But by the time she comes home, Beth is already recovering. Really, I think it's important to remember that Meg and Jo basically save Beth's life. And so Marmee comes home. Everybody's thrilled to see her. There's this reunion that I think is super interesting that the authorial voice here is so strong. Like, I think the chapter even opens with the I. So
yeah.
I don't think I have any words in which to tell the meeting of the mothers and daughters. So then Lori is dispatched to go get Amy. She's been with Aunt March. And we thankfully have a quick scene with Polly the parrot, who is like one of the best characters in the whole novel. So Marmee comes to see Amy. There's this emotional reunion in which they sort of talk about how Amy's going to be a better person now because of Beth. And she worries a little bit about whether or not Amy is turning Catholic, but thank goodness she's not. So they talk about her sort of resolve to be a better person because she wants people to care about her if she were to get sick. Then we switch back to the home again. And Jo approaches Marmee to say that she's concerned that because John actually is falling in love with Meg, so she found out about the hidden glove that he carries around with him in kind of a creepy way. My students always found that super creepy, that he keeps her glove. And Marmee, I have to say, kind of disappoints Jo and is not as disapproving of the whole situation as I think Jo hopes she's going to be. So they sort of circle around this topic for a while before Meg comes in and shuts it down and they go to bed. So all of Jo's fears about growing up and about losing Meg and men entering into this domestic sphere are raised in this chapter. So it's a really great one.
Yes, it's a fascinating one structurally because we've been so laser focused on Beth and Beth's recovery.
Yeah.
The chapter opens a set point. Anyway, marriage, heteropessimism.
Right.
Yeah, we get Beth's recovery, the very brief cameo from Polly who calls...
Yeah.
He calls Amy a good girl, blesses her buttons, and begs her to come and take a walk, dear, in his most affable tone. So,
and then the last chapter, I think he invites the spider to come and take a walk, which I love. That's one of the most hilarious parts in the whole book, I think.
Well, now, and this is interesting. I'm just noticing, Polly, he, him, his.
Yeah.
That's
You're right.
What's that about?
Polly's genderqueer.
Do we have a confirmed genderqueer character? When I'm going to spell the parent,
we did it. Queer ferret. Yeah. Surely Polly is a girl's name, even when it's applied to a parrot.
Yeah. I mean, I call in Polly historians if, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to like full tech Little Women control F Polly and just see if this is consistent. Because this is fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Polly had to be fed, took Polly with her. Polly's always been a he, him. Interesting.
Wow.
That's
all right, then. That's going into the article on this.
Yeah, and we can think about Polly the parrot and pirates and like ships as a third space in which queerness was perhaps more acceptable. I mean, we can really zoom out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where I wanted to begin.
No, but it's good. Yeah.
But
it's good.
So this chapter contains a lot of the most openly queer statements from Jo. The first, but not the last in the book, instance of Joe saying, I just wish I could marry Meg myself and keep her safe in the family.
So queer.
What do we think of that?
I think it's fabulous. She's sort of scrambling here to come up with all these ways in which Meg won't get married. But before that, she's talking about how she doesn't know if Meg cares for him or not, right? Because in novels, the girls show it by starting and blushing, fainting away, growing thin, and acting like fools. Now, Meg don't do anything of the sort. She eats and drinks and sleeps like a sensible creature, right? So, like, it doesn't look like it does in novels, but what could it look like, right? Maybe it's going to look like this. Like, I'll marry her. I'll marry my sister and keep her in the family. She'll do anything to keep her sister in the family. But because she's this sort of masculine figure anyway, she might as well just marry her, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I think I've spoken before about how when I was writing that piece for Oprah Daily, I sort of included this, I just wish I could marry Meg myself, as a statement of Joe being interested in marrying a woman. And my editor was like, are you sure? we don't want to be seen as promoting marrying your sister.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But it's, to me, I read that more as, it's such a baffling statement, for one. It's just incredibly odd. But tags in with, there's another, you know, she really starts ranting and is like, the world will end if Meg marries John Brooke.
Absolutely. We'll go lovering around the house.
Yeah. He's going to carry her off and make a hole in the family, and I shall break my heart, and everything will be abominably uncomfortable. And she says, oh, dearie me, why weren't we all boys?
Right? Which I think is a really interesting statement, right? Yeah. Because it's not as if they wouldn't get married if they were boys, right? But it's like somehow because they're girls, being married disrupts that whole circle. Like they get sort of carried off to some other household. But of course she doesn't. Meg moves in next door,
yeah.
You know? So it's this weird statement, like men don't have to give as much of themselves or give up as much if they get married.
I guess she seems to be like grasping for solutions, and her solutions don't make a lot of sense in reality. I read that and I'm like, okay, so I mean, Joe, why weren't we all boys? I imagine this is a thought to which Joe returns a lot. Right.
Yes. But never for all of them. Right.
No.
I mean, that's what's interesting is she's suggesting it as like a possibility for everybody.
But even that, like, you're right. Brothers would go out and get married. Would they feel as close to one another if they were all boys? Joe's really on one here.
Yeah.
I think the anxiety about Meg getting married winds up being more about Joe's anxiety about becoming a woman.
Absolutely.
And getting married, right?
Yeah. I mean, earlier it says that she says she can't follow Meg into a world of admiration, lovers, and things of that sort. So like Meg is like on a trajectory to that world, and Joe can't follow her because she can't marry herself, but she also can't fall in love with the guy.
Yeah. And she says, I just wish I could marry Meg myself and keep her safe in the family. She later says, I'm disappointed about Meg, for I'd planned to have her marry Teddy by and by.
That's another solution.
So Teddy is, I guess, like family. And it's shocking because...
And it cracks me up because Joe is always trying to like give Teddy away to somebody else.
Right.
You know? Here she's like, well, he could marry Meg. And then like later on in the book, remember Beth when she figures out she's dying? Joe thinks, well, maybe she's in love with Teddy. And wouldn't it be great if she like, she so does not want Teddy, you know, like she doesn't want Lori, but she'll give him up to everybody else. But basically, that's another queer solution, right? Because she thinks of Lori as a girl or herself as a boy.
Yeah,
it's not a heterosexual marriage that she's planning for them. You know, she's planning something for her own convenience.
She's like, okay, so if Meg marries Teddy, then we'll all be part of the same kind of family unit.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that Meg is the first solution. When she loses that, she's fine. Beth is in love with Beth.
Right.
Perfect. Beth and Lori. I see the vision. Right. And when Beth is like, what are you talking about?
I'm dying. Yeah. It reminds me of Emily Dickinson falling in love with her sister-in-law and before they get married. And she basically marries her lover or the woman she loves off to her brother so she can keep her in the house forever. Like they live next door to each other, you know? Apparently this was a 19th century solution to these things.
No, I mean, you're saying it. And I feel like that's even a trope in queer literature is like a lavender marriage or you marry my brother or like I marry your brother so that like we can kind of close, right? Like that's a thing.
Absolutely.
And what's fascinating is that Lori does end up with a merch sister in the end.
Right.
We cycle through with Meg, struck out, Beth, nope. Hated it.
No. Yeah.
What do you think that says about Louisa May Alcott's authorial hand in this relationship? Was there some importance for her in pairing up Lori with Amy in the end?
Well, I think it goes along with what you always insist, right? That Lori is a March sister, yeah. Right? And that he will do anything to make that real. Mm-hmm. That I think his marrying Amy and seeking marriage all over the March family is about trying to find a way to formally be part of that family.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, when I said I have my issues with Lori, I think part of that is because letting him in is the beginning of the end.
Yeah.
I mean, they had this tight domestic female circle. And then the second they meet Lori, he becomes part of the PC and the PO. He becomes,
yep,
goes on their like adventures when they're doing Pilgrim's Progress. He's going to become part of the plays. And through that door comes John Brooks. So,
yep.
And he becomes Amy's husband. So really letting him in destroys the little Eden that they've created, the little female Eden that they've created with father conveniently going off to war, you know?
That's very true. Yeah, it's like something is lost and gained.
Yeah.
Lori's admission to the family. I'm thinking about the moment in the 1994 film where Lori is courting Amy and he says, "I envy Joe's happiness. I envy Professor Bear's happiness. I envy John Brooke for marrying Meg. I hate Fred Vaughn, who was Amy's suitor at the time. Uh-huh. If Beth had a lover, I would despise him too. Just as you have always known that you would never marry a pauper, I have always known I should be part of the March family."
Wow. Yeah, I had forgotten about that. Wow. So that really makes it overt.
Yeah. And that is not a thread that Greta Gerwig pulls on.
Yeah. Well, he's such a creepy character in the 1994 movie, too.
It's Christian Bale. And at the time, we have to remember, at the time, Christian Bale was newsies. He was like a little lad. But he delivers that monologue like Batman, like Patrick Bateman. It's just like Kubrick stare at Amy the whole time. So there's almost a sinister air to it, which I think is very funny. But I think it also speaks to what we've been talking about here is it's this kind of everyone marrying one another is endgame, not just because the novel must pull from familiar characters, but obviously Professor Bear comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
No, yeah. She's seeking like a narratively satisfying resolution for Lori. And I, for whatever reason, it was just really important to her that this, I think, kind of gender ambiguous feminine boy get to be part of the March family.
Yeah.
Like it's something I talk about when I talk about people being skeptical of, oh, so Joe just isn't interesting enough to be a woman. I'm like, well, no, like if you read the book, Alcott creates a space for Joe to really want to be a man and for Lori to really want to be, I think, wanting to be a woman and evidencing that in several places, but also just wanting to be part of this family full of women and to escape from his very sex segregated male space. And
right.
I mean, if you think about like Little Women, what is Little Women if not just like a story of this like all female space and this all male space next to one another and the two just by osmosis joining right. one another and upsetting the order of things, but making everyone happier in the end.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they merge basically. So Meg marries John.
Yeah.
Amy marries Lori. Beth's only relationship with a man is with Mr. Lawrence.
Right. Yeah.
She sort of becomes his granddaughter.
Yeah.
Joe is really the only one who branches out, even though it's through her that they make that first connection.
Yeah, it's something like even this, the nuclear family structure is just, I'm going to take that back as soon as I say it, because I don't think there's anything nuclear about Little Women's depiction of a family structure. Like we've talked before about how in like the addition of Hannah, for instance, she essentially creates a household that is run by two women, right? Yeah. And Lori is essentially being raised by two men,
right?
Although I'm not intimating.
True. I never thought about that. But yeah,
I'm not intimating anything about John Brooke and Grandpa Lawrence. Although, like, that's a fun. If anyone wants to read the fan fiction, I will read it with curiosity.
That's funny too.
But even like the home is not enough for Joe.
Yeah.
Right. In the same way, the home was not enough for Lou. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and she's the one who goes off to war.
Yeah, I mean, it's what's interesting is the Meg, Jo, Beth, and Amy book, which I'm like looking right at. That's one of the graphic novels. Jo comes to realize that she's gay, but she doesn't end up with a woman.
Mm-hmm.
It just sort of happens. In Kathleen Gross's book, Freddie, it just becomes like a cute, like 13-year-old girl in Joe's like school paper.
Oh, wow.
And that's her take on Bear.
Uh-huh. Oh, wow. But I think, well, we're not talking about Bear.
We're not talking about
Bear. I wish we could talk about, let me come back and talk about Mr. Bear, because I think that relationship is queer too. So.
Well, yeah, I mean.
We can't do it.
We've got nothing but time.
Yeah.
Seriously, tell me, why do you think Professor Bear and...
Well, I think he has sort of feminine aspects to him. I don't know. I didn't read that chapter in preparation for this, right, or that bit in preparation for this. But I do think he has feminine aspects to him. I don't know. I'd have to go back and revisit it in order to remake that argument.
I will say the only time Bear has ever been appealing to me as a character, I do think like Freddie Bear is like very cute in Kathleen Gross's book. But the real hitting of the mark for me was in George Cukor's 1930s Little Women. I don't know the name of the actor. I can maybe look it up. But that Professor Bear, he's sort of been like de-aged and turned into a hunk in some
storylines. Yeah.
George Cukor, a famously openly gay director, playing with Katharine Hepburn, who I don't know that we have time to unpack all of that, but
right.
Katharine Hepburn, very much someone who said, I thought I was the wrong sex. I went by Jimmy. I've lived my life as a man. So we have, I would argue, a trans masculine actor portraying Joe, right? And the relationship between Katharine Hepburn's Joe and George Cukor's version of Professor Bear is this older man taking this young twink out on the town and showing Joe opera and ballet and art museums and kind of exposing Joe to this world beyond their own knowledge. And it's rather sexless and it's more about like camaraderie and friendship until Professor Bear pops the question and Joe is like, oh, I'm actually really happy with you. And I think what George Cukor is bringing there is sort of an element of intergenerational gay male relationships.
Oh, interesting.
And how older gay men can kind of mentor and enrich the lives of younger gay men who are like coming into their own and coming out. So that's my interpretation of the movie. That's the only time Bear has ever clicked for me. I think that Bear is just lovely. Do you have a favorite cinematic Bear?
No, I don't. I mean, I don't. I agree the relationship in the book is tricky and most of my students hate him, you know, and hate the solution. I don't love that she marries at the end, but I think if she does marry somebody, I don't mind that it's weird.
Yeah.
I kind of appreciate that it's not Lori.
Yeah. And how do we square, we are discussing Bear, how do we square the eventual marriage to Bear with Joe and Marmee's discussion of marriage in this chapter?
Well, he's certainly not a rich man.
No.
Right. And Marmee says, I don't want you to marry a rich man. I mean, Marmee wants him to marry for love, and virtue. I mean, I think we can speculate about whether or not she loves Bear, whether that's like a convincing thing. You know, what I think, I'm gonna dodge your question.
Okay.
Because I guess, you know, it's sort of what Marmee would want, right? I mean, she wants him to marry for love, to be comfortable, but not to marry for money or anything like that. But I think one weird thing about Marmee here, I think, like she ends the chapter by saying she does not love John yet, but will soon learn to.
Right.
And there's sort of like a way in which, you know, in that she knows that John is interested in her and that Joe knows that John is interested in her, that Lori knows that John is interested in her. Everybody knows about this except for Meg, really. Yeah. And everybody's just kind of watching her. It's this sort of like little experiment, and apparently Marmee will know before Meg does that she's in love with him. I don't know. It's this weird sort of way of thinking about watching your children, I don't know, having your children fall in love and move on. Like you're kind of, she's kind of pulling the strings there.
Yeah, there's a mixture of satisfaction and regret when she says, oh, Meg doesn't love John yet, but soon.
Yeah.
Is that just part and parcel of anything that any parent feels watching a kid grow up?
I think so, but it's weirder than that though, right? So she, a couple chapters before that, somebody's talking about John and she's like watching Meg to see how Meg responds. And then when she's gone, I think Mr. Lawrence writes to her and says something about Hannah guarding pretty Meg.
Right.
There's this way in which like sort of Meg's sexuality is burgeoning and they're all like so aware of what this might mean that they've got to observe her to find out the exact moment when she really needs to get married.
Yeah, like the remark about Hannah guarding Meg like a dragon. That phrase struck out to me because there's a similar note in a letter that Alcott wrote talking about how she guards her own mother like a dragon.
Oh, wow.
And that was specifically in the context of, by that point, Alcott was a celebrity and they were getting a lot of visitors to the house. And it was sort of just bearing on like ABBA Alcott's nerves.
Yes.
And to have so many, you know, people like banging on the windows and wanting to come in and meet the real Joe.
Right.
And but even then she's like, well, I simply, that makes me uncomfortable. But really, I'm telling you not to come for Marmy, for ABBA. That's the real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, God, if ever a woman deserved some rest, it was ABBA Alcott.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. And I mean, maybe because we were talking about Marmy, ABBA Alcott, we know, was a very vocal suffragist. She was saying, like, I plan to vote even if my daughters have to carry me. She never got the chance, which is tragic, to vote. But she was a progressive figure as well. And she was often the breadwinner for the family when Bronson was indisposed or having an episode. She would work. She would earn an income, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So she was a very unconventional mother figure. In a way, I think Marmy is in many ways less.
Absolutely. Yeah. She's far more conventional than ABBA Alcott.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she's doing her duty like during the Civil War, but that's it. I mean, all of that is absent from Little Women. You know, I mean, that's one of the huge questions of the novel, I think. You know, where is the abolition? Where are Black people in this book? Where are the politics? And I mean, it would be a very different book and probably wouldn't have had the life it has, but you can't help but wonder what might it have been.
Yeah, no, I mean, I have to wonder about maybe the commercial choices that went into that. As for where are the Black people in Little Women, there is a brief mention in one of the closing chapters as Jo establishes her school that she accepts a Black student other schools had rejected.
Right.
Which I'm not going to read because there is like a 19th century racial slur in that sentence, but she joyfully accepts a Black student, which again, Bronson had accepted Black students to his school, and that had been all these wealthy white Boston families had pulled their students, and it was part of the family's economic downturn. So that kind of comes in right toward the very end. We get another version of that with Lori being like half Italian and having dark brown skin and curly Black hair. We've talked about how like that, even that has kind of been whitewashed out of the story in subsequent years.
Sure. I've had students who read Hannah as sort of a Black figure, right?
Yeah.
This sort of second mother. Yeah. I mean, not intentionally African-American. Like, I don't think Alcott is writing a Black character, but I think there are ways that she can be seen as that kind of figure.
Yeah, I can see how a modern reader could maybe miss that Hannah's Irish and be like, so is this housekeeper is Black? Because the socio-political racial dynamics of the day were such that Irish people were not considered white. And I talked in the episode with Egan Dean at some length about the bolderization of Hannah's speech and how, like, even when she writes, she has this kind of racist pidgin English.
Right.
So I don't think it's appropriate to say, you know, like, oh, Hannah is a Black character because she is Irish, but she certainly is a character of color of the day in the same way that Lori is, right? And it's another thing. I think one thing I would love to see, and we've talked before about So Many Beginnings, which is a Little Women retelling by Bethany C. Morrill, which takes the action of Little Women and places it in a freed person's colony and the entire cast is Black.
I don't know this.
That's a superb book. I really recommend it. But so Lori, along with the rest of the cast, is Black. And he's also, he's presented as having dark brown skin and curly Black hair in Meg, Jo, Beth, and Amy. But just owing to, like, in Morrow's book, because the entire cast is Black, the entire context of the book has been shaped by it now being in a freed person's colony. The question of kind of like Lori's racial marginalization relative to the marches isn't something that really has been explored. Well, and so it's interesting then in light of that, I mean, is that a factor in Marmy saying Lori isn't grown up enough for Meg? He's altogether too much of a weathercock for anyone to depend on. Like, is that Marmy having a little anti-Italian racism moment? Like, what's going on there?
I don't know, because she's been supportive of him. She's letting him in. But certainly, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of something that Daniel Okrent said in our interview with him. He said that Whether Laurie continued to advance in society would depend largely on who he married. And if he married like a Sicilian woman, then his whiteness would effectively disappear. Whereas if he married a March sister, that would whiten him in a way.
Well, it's interesting to think about like his grandfather, the way his grandfather keeps a sort of tight rein on him in the beginning. Like maybe the grandfather, maybe Mr. Lawrence is aware of this, right? And is holding on to him until he can find this family that he can kind of release him into, aware that there are four options here for marriage, right? I mean, we could see him as controlling this situation as much as Marmee is. I mean, in 19th century, parents did that. They thought about, you know, what people do that now, right? They think about where they're positioning their children in order to find potential mates.
Yeah. And I mean, especially after Laurie's father said, to hell with you, Grandpa, and ran off with an Italian woman.
Right.
There's even more control on Laurie, which is...
Well, right. Because if he marries someone of questionable ethnicity or race, then the bloodline is... It can't be sort of taken back to white, right? The whiteness is too diluted at that point.
Yeah. I'm thinking of... Are you familiar with the painting Ham's Redemption?
No.
So this is an extraordinarily racist Brazilian painting of three generations of women, and their skin tones become light. They're all like in a family portrait type setting, and their skin tones are lighter by the generation. And the youngest woman is holding a baby in her arms, and the baby is completely white. And the very dark-skinned grandmother is lifting her arms to heaven, like, hallelujah.
Wow.
It's so... And I'm going to have to look up when that was painted.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was 1895. Was when that painting was done. It was by a Spanish painter. He completed it while teaching in Rio de Janeiro. So it's not contemporary to Little Women. It's actually 30 years after Little Women.
Same idea, though.
But it's very much expressing this idea of, isn't this wonderful that, like, the bloodline has become, like, it's just...
Yeah.
I don't know how we got here, but...
That could be another reason why Joe and Laurie aren't supposed to be together. I mean, they're both brown.
Right. Joe is often described as having brown skin versus Laurie's dark brown skin.
Right. So what would the result be, right? But Amy, of course.
Yeah, a regular snow maiden.
Yeah, right. And I mean, it's interesting, this chapter, I'd never thought about this before, but this chapter, it's always seemed fragmented to me that it has this Laurie and Amy and Marmee section and then this Marmee, but maybe it's not that fragmented.
No,
maybe we're supposed to see here and in that previous fabulous chapter where Amy writes her will, sort of like the early germ of that relationship between Laurie and Amy.
Right, yeah.
So it's not just the Meg conversation with Joe, between Joe and Marmee, that's confidential. And it's also not just this conversation about Catholicism, which we haven't touched on, but it's also this Laurie-Amy connection, right?
Yep.
Where he comforts her, falls asleep there in the room.
Yeah.
So maybe that's part, maybe these are all part and parcel of the same thing.
Yeah, I think like we don't, the racial dynamics of Little Women aren't often talked about, which I think is a real shame. And I think is also partially due to just like the picture was perhaps more different than we in 2022 can even really comprehend. We have Bronson Alcott, who was an abolitionist, but was also held really regressive beliefs about skin color. And we've talked before about how wanting the abolition of slavery didn't necessarily mean a belief in racial equality.
Absolutely.
And how Bronson Alcott, who was willing to risk his entire family's income and drive them into poverty over the moral principle of admitting a black student to his school, was also vehement that darker skin tones were associated with worse behavior. And even looking at his own children, Lou Alcott had a slightly darker complexion and darker hair than her sisters. And he was like, this must be why she like misbehaves so much.
Right.
Right. And, you know, that comes into play here just as far as what we know of Amy is like she has blonde ringlets. She is a regular snow maiden compared to like Joe's chestnut hair and brown skin. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can take brown skin to mean, who knows what that means from an 19th century perspective. But it's interesting how all of these things are coming into play here and kind of just bubbling underneath the surface in a very real way, I think.
Well, yeah. And Alcott herself, based on My Contraband, has some problematic views on race. Like most 19th century Americans, she had her share of...
Yeah.
racism, and she certainly privileges like the light skin characters in that story and imagines sort of a romantic past
yeah
for the enslaved characters and
Yeah. And obviously that doesn't deal with that subject matter as directly in Little Women as she does elsewhere. But I think we can't, like, Bethany C. Morrow, in talking about So Many Beginnings, was like, if the Civil War was background noise for you, we are like, we are not the same.
Right.
Right. And how making the March family Black and putting them in a freed person's colony changes dramatically, not every aspect of their lives, but everything from where their father is to the hobbies that they can take up.
Right. I've got to read this.
It's really good. Yes. Jo is still a writer. She's a journalist. Like, she's sort of an earlier Ida B. Wells figure. And like, she wants to tell the story of the freed person's colony and get it out there. But then Meg's aspiration isn't to be an actress. And Beth, she's a really talented seamstress. Amy is a dancer as opposed to an artist, just because dance was something that would have been available to her in a way that painting wouldn't have, right?
Right.
So it's like so many things have to be reshaped if you change the context that dramatically. Whereas, again, in this book, for as much as we talk about American Girl dolls a lot on this podcast, but so American Girls, they have two characters now from the Second World War. There's Molly, who is a white girl from Illinois on the home front. Her dad's at war. He's a doctor in the war. She's waiting for him to come home, right? So that's the one character. And her stories are largely, the entire first Molly book is like, will I be able to make a Halloween costume when fabric is rationed?
That's her plight.
And then the second World War character that they've introduced is Nanea, who is a Hawaiian girl.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And the first Nanea book, it opens with, she has this dog that she loves, and the dog is scared of loud noises, and there's been, like, someone dropped a pan in the kitchen, so the dog is all skittish. And she's like, oh,
no. I can see where this is going. Right.
And then she goes on into the garden to pick some vegetables for breakfast, and, you know, like, start Japanese bombers are
flying over. I knew it.
She's like, oh, no, my dad works at Pearl Harbor.
Oh, no.
And you compare this to, like, Molly's story.
Yeah.
Actually, Molly's like, will I be able to put together an awesome, like, hula dancer all week?
Oh, my God. Is it actually a hula dancer outfit?
Literally a hula dancer.
And then literally that next bit they do about World War II is a Hawaiian girl.
Right. So Molly's like, I think it would be really fun to dress up as a Hawaiian girl. And then Nanea is like, oh, my God, my dad works.
My dad going to die.
My school was blown up. And my dog, who is scared of loud noises, has run off and we can't find it. So, like, I think it's actually one of the, as a connoisseur of children's literature, I think the Nanea book is one of the most effective in this series, because it not only like puts Nanea at the center of this very horrific event, but the remainder of the book is kind of a hero's journey looking for her missing dog.
And oh my God.
That's what takes her like through her community and to the hospital and all these other places, because she's looking for her lost dog. And those are two very different stories of two home front experiences, in the same way that Alcott's Little Women and Morrow's Little Women are radically different because of the race of their characters. And we can say, like, Molly's dad is at war. That must be terrifying. She doesn't know if he can come home. At the same time, Nene is looking up and seeing bombers flying overhead and is like, my dad is at Pearl Harbor right now.
I mean, and at the time Alcott's writing this novel, it's in the middle of Reconstruction. Right. I mean, the southern states are finally coming up with new constitutions. They're electing new legislatures. And all of this is going on, and there's none of it here. There's no sort of foreshadowing of it here.
Why do you think that is?
I think she was savvy, right? I mean, I think Alcott was always aware of her audience, and she needed to make money with her writing. And she, you know, who knows what Alcott would have done had she had enough money to support her writing. You know, who knows what she would have written. But I also don't want to lament this book that never existed, right? Yeah. I think it's really interesting to think about the fact that she knew what she was writing, who she was writing for. I mean, she sort of made fun of it, but yeah, she was a savvy writer and she was a professional. I mean, at a moment when not a lot of American women writers were professionals.
Yes.
I always get a little bit frustrated by this sort of argument that, like, the sensational stories were what she really wanted to write.
Right.
And then this was the book that she had to write. I mean, we all bitch about what we're writing from time to time, even books that we love. You know, I could love the project I'm working on and I can write an email about how much I hate it. So I never really want to take all of those comments, because she put her family into this and her sister who died and she loves. I find it hard to believe that she hated this book as much as she sometimes acted like she did.
No, I mean, it certainly transformed her life. It's the lens through which a lot of people view her. through which most people view her. It's also true that the sensation stories were economic too.
Sure, she was absolutely not
writing these horror novellas for her health.
Right.
She was trying to make money. And this is something that personally gets my goat, which is that Alcott was an incredibly shrewd and hardline business person. Mm-hmm. And nobody talks about, well, I think there's some like fun negotiation in Gerwig's movie. We get the very first scene where the editor's, he's like, what? Like, we pay 25 for things of this sort. We'll pay 20 for that. Love you.
Yeah.
By the end, we have Joe is like negotiating for copyright. She's wearing a snazzy little bowler hat.
Yeah.
She's like, what percentage of the royalties am I going to get? One of my favorite discoveries from the Alcott archives is, this is in the Houghton Library at Harvard, and they only have the editor's side of the correspondence. Like, they don't have Lou's letters to the editors, but they have the editor's side. So there is one letter that the editor sends, and he's like, the very idea of you asking for more money on this next project, which I think was Eight Cousins or a Rose, and it was an old-fashioned girl. He's like, you want more money for an old-fashioned girl. Little Women might be a fluke. We don't know. How dare you ask for more money? You have other options. If you want to like go publish with someone else, then you do it. But that royalty rate you're asking for is highway robbery. How dare you? And like, he's being like just an absolute, the nerve of you to ask for more money after phenomenal success. And so that was one letter. How dare you? The matter is closed. We are giving you this lower royalty amount than you asked for. And then there's a gap in the correspondence where Lou wrote some letter back. We don't have that. It's not in the Harvard archive. And then the next letter from the editor is just one line like, dear Ms. Alcott, we will pay you the royalty rate of that you asked for. Like,
oh, I wish I knew what we knew what we she said to him.
Woman knows so bad what was in that gap. But
yes,
she was like,
she was a pro. Oh,
bitch better have my money. That was
right.
Even after this one success, like, she was not going to bow down for anyone. She was like, I know my worth now, and I'm not afraid to negotiate, which gets left out in the picture, I think, especially in like what you pointed to, the thing of she didn't really like writing Little Women. She loved writing the sensation stories. She wrote those for money. You know?
Yeah.
But
you're making me think too. I always think it's so weird. So all the movies, and I don't want to go off into a big discussion of the movie, all the movies always want to end, or most of the movies want to end with, they want to conflate Joe and Louise May Alcott and end with the book being published. And what that book is always changes based on the particular movie.
Mm-hmm.
And literary historians, you've probably heard this before, but they all hate the end of the Gerwig movie because how they depict the printing press. Has anybody told? So like the printing press is depicted all wrong for the 1860s. I mean, it's like one little printing press in a room that would have taken 500,000 hours to print books, you know? But of course, it's so quaint.
Yeah.
The movies can't resist that urge. When really in Little Women, which I think is super interesting, is that Jo publishes lots of different things in Little Women. I mean, she's publishing poetry and stories and all sorts of things like all throughout the whole novel. But they always like that sort of grand gesture at the end.
Yeah. Even at one point, Jo publishes a novel in Little Women. She gets it published and it just doesn't do what she wanted it to do.
Yeah. And it's not at the end. It's not that grand gesture.
It's like a learning opportunity for her.
Yeah. Well, and it's so funny because my students sometimes say, well, I hated it at the end because she didn't become an author. And I'm like, what are you talking about? She's been an author the whole time.
Yeah.
Like, they want that grand ending at the end, like at the movies, but she's been writing the whole time. We've had this. We have what we want.
She has already published her first stories in the newspaper.
Yeah.
At this point in the novel that we're at, chapter 20, she's still a teenager.
Like, yeah.
She's like a published author, and Marmee's patting her on the head, being like, oh, just stay little as long as you can, right?
Right, I know.
Alcott published her first book, not even her first story. She published her first printed book when she was 17 years old.
Yeah.
It was a collection of stories and poems that she'd written for Emerson's young daughter.
Yeah, they were like flower fables or something like that.
Flower fables. And like, you, when you say that, it completely changes the narrative from like,
yeah,
she wasn't this struggling creative. She was like, first of all, even though she lived in poverty, she and her family knew some of the most influential literary figures of that time.
Absolutely. I mean, come on. Emerson was like a family friend.
And to say, like, I published my first book at 17, it was for Emerson's kid. Okay, so that just played on, like, how this came about, right?
Yeah.
Not to take anything away from that accomplishment, but she had, if not wealth, she certainly had connections.
Yeah.
She, like, knew people, and she had learned from them a lot of the business of publishing as well.
Sure.
and had kind of like carved out a lane for herself. And I think it's important to hammer home like how the business sense and the way that often the motivation was economic rather than creative, because something I got a lot, like kind of the number one refrain from Turves when I published my thread earlier this year about my belief that like Alcott is best understood as a trans man, was Alcott wanted to be a writer because women couldn't write. I'm like, where do we like that? Like,
because women couldn't write?
Women couldn't write, or they couldn't publish their writing. And I'm like, do we want to go through Alcott's publication history? Like, you are so...
Well, and also, women were among the most popular writers in the 19th century. Yeah.
There were occasions where Alcott wrote under a pseudonymous name, and that could have been for gender reasons. Alcott often published just as L.M. Alcott, mm-hmm. right? The first edition of Little Women just says L.M. Alcott. A.M. Barnard was another pseudonym. So both of those sort of have a place of gender neutrality, right? Right. A.M. Barnard might have had just as much to do with wanting to keep Alcott's name as the children's friend, or like the person who writes these children's novels so that people aren't like scandalized by the, you know,
right.
by the right. adult horror novels about like ghosts and cross-dressing. But Alcott, at the end of the day, was a business person. She was a good business person. She enriched not just herself, but her family. And that doesn't get talked about. And I mean, this is a chapter all about marriage and women's economic prospects. Literary wealth had not happened for Alcott at this point when she wrote this.
Right.
Earning the daily, like Alcott had been earning her own income for some years, but was not rich by any means, but was also disinterested in marrying for any reason, it seemed, by this.
Yeah.
What do you make of that balance?
As far as I know, I mean, people like to say that Alcott was in love with Thoreau, but I don't know where
Emerson.
People get
Emerson.
That really. Well, no, people say that she was kind of in love with Thoreau for some reason, but who would be in love with Thoreau? I have no idea. She wrote a poem called Thoreau's Flute, for whatever you want.
I think you are thinking of Emerson, because Emerson married Anna Alcott, her older sister, and kissed Anna on the cheek during the ceremony. And she was like, it might be worth getting married to get a kiss from Emerson.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it has been so lovely. Do you have any parting words for our listeners? Last thoughts on this wonderful chapter here?
My last thought is so trivial, but it's what I've been thinking about through this whole thing. So we were talking about keeping this female society and sort of not creating a hole in the society, and that Lori enters in. And I had the weirdest experience this morning. I was going to get coffee and I remembered that I had the audiobook for Little Women on my phone. So I was like, I'm going to listen to chapter 20 while I drive. And the weirdest thing is that I had forgotten that it's narrated by Christina Ricci. And I just got done watching Yellow Jackets. Christina Ricci plays this absolutely creepy character in Yellow Jackets.
Yeah.
Like, there are no spoilers here, but plane crashes. It's got this girl's soccer team on it, and it crashes like in the middle of nowhere. And Christina Ricci, she's like the adult version of this child character. She's an outcast. She's the team scorekeeper or something. And she whips into gear and starts taking care of everybody. She ends up chopping this guy's leg off because the plane landing on his leg. And then later in life, you see Christina Ricci as this figure who's kind of crazy, you know? I mean, I'm listening, and she's also kind of wanting all these girls to like stay together and be this society and nobody to leave the island and all this stuff. So it's like this weird double take when I was like, oh my God, Christina Ricci is narrating Little Women. Like trying to sort of keep this family circle together.
That's right. Well, okay. So then parting question, I guess, Joe, Meg, Amy, Beth, Lori are on a plane. The plane goes down. What happens?
Wow. Beth sacrifices herself. She takes care of everyone until they're all going to die and they cannibalize her or something. I don't know. Joe gets help, don't you think? So Joe packs off into the wilderness.
Mm. Yeah, Joe's like, I'm Katniss Everdeen now. It's been real.
Right. Gets them rescued.
Yeah.
No, they can't eat Beth. They wouldn't do that. Holly. They eat Polly.
Polly. Which, by the way, I did look that up. Wikipedia says it is a given name, most often feminine. It mentions four male Pollys.
Yeah.
And they are, okay, so all of them are like nicknamed Pollys, like Bill Perkins, known as Polly. Graham Farmer, nicknamed Polly. Polly Umrigar, who is an Indian cricketer whose first name was Palan. And then Polly Wolf, whose first name was Roy, and he was a baseball player. So, who can say which regards?
Yeah, I think that is perhaps the greatest discovery of our hour together.
Yeah.
I think. And it will change the face of scholarship on Little Women.
We've cracked this wide open. It's okay.
I'm not.
So
it's a victory.
Dr. Putzi, it's been lovely. Where can people find you online? Where can they buy your books? Is there anything you'd like to
push? Oh, the usual places. I teach at William & Mary, so you can find me there and you can write to me and let me know what you think about Polly.
Yeah. I mean, apply to William & Mary and take Dr. Putzi's classes. I don't know if 150 years of Little Women will be offered again. It sounds like that was a...
Yeah, it's no longer the 150th anniversary. So I did it for 2 years in a row, 2018 and 2019, to mark the sort of 2-year publication of the two books. But I do think I'm going to leave next year and I'm going to be writing. And then the year after that, maybe I'll teach a Louisa May Alcott major author class. So.
Well, I will be fascinated and I might try to audit. So keep me posted.
Anytime.
As always, I am your host, Peyton Thomas. You can find me online at peytonthomas.ca. I have quit Twitter since Elon Musk's hostile takeover, but you can find me at peytonthomas.ca. You can also buy my book, Both Sides Now, wherever fine books are sold. And I will also say that you've been very generous with your ratings and reviews. We currently have a perfect 5 out of 5 stars on the US version of Apple Podcasts. However, we did just get our first mean 1-star review from a TERF in the United Kingdom. Of course, it would be the United Kingdom. Wherever you live, but especially if you live in the UK, if you enjoy the show, go ahead and drop a rating and a review for us. Your reviews will help other people find the show, and they will also balance out the TERFs. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next week.